Tonight on Arena, Tara Aracht on her Celebrating the Voice event at the National Concert Hall, and Maeve Kennedy on a new edition of her mother's debut novel, A Time Out Worn. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTG Arena. Next week, Celebrating the Voice, a five-day professional development programme for young singers at advanced stages of vocal development, will take place at the National Concert Hall. This event involves 12 young singers and has 12 events, including two performances on St. Valentine's Day, as well as public masterclasses, vocal coaching, conversations and panel discussions. The programme was designed and will be hosted by internationally acclaimed mezzo-soprano Tara Aracht, who is currently artist-in-residence at the National Concert Hall. Tara will be joined by six Irish and international industry experts from the areas of performance, opera, artist management, opera and artist management, finance, taxation and vocal health. Dr. Paul Quack, a laryngologist and laryngeal surgeon, will be part of that consultation, and he will be joining us shortly. I think, in fact, he's on the line right now, as is Tara Aracht, joining us. Paul, I believe, is in the US, and Tara is joining us from Germany. Tara, you had done an event like this and it had been growing, but I think when you took over in your position as artist in residence at the National Concert Hall, you really wanted to build this whole idea of celebrating into the voice into something, into a quite big national event.
Good evening, Sean. Delighted to be speaking to you. That's absolutely right. So this is our actual, this is the third time that we're going to run this course. And this was a brainchild. It sort of came over a cup of coffee, an incredibly interesting conversation with Pauline Ashwood, another loud lady, who, like myself, did most of her training in the Northeast. And when we ran it the first time, and even the second time, we ran it and we focused it on the needs of the singers in the Northeast. So once I was given the opportunity to become artist in residence, I, of course, decided, OK, let's see if we can do this as a bigger piece of outreach nationally and open it up to everybody in the country. I've obviously been incredibly lucky with the people that I've met during my career. And as often as possible, I try and bring those people home along with the things that I've learned. So it's an incredible privilege, really, to get the opportunity to do it this time.
And I just wonder, I mean, I don't know what point we will say you're at in your career at this point. You're certainly well established. We know that, Tara. But when you look at, you have 12 young singers who are going to be part of the series of events over the coming 5 days. When you look at even choosing those 12 now, how different a landscape is opera, opera training and the potential for an operatic career? How different a landscape is that in Ireland today than it was when you were starting out?
That's a very interesting question. You know, it's completely different. And it's one of the very rare things that is now much more positive après COVID than it was before COVID. The landscape for employment opportunities in Ireland has quadrupled, if not more. And that namely is with the incredible work that Irish National Opera do. And there's so many new opportunities that are there now that certainly weren't around. The difference is that the young students now are almost thrown into the industry directly without having to have had any sort of international experience or time in a room where you learn from other professionals. And it is incredible, but it means it's even more important then that we share these business tools. I mean, the singing, the actual voice is such a, I mean, it's the most important thing, but it's in the bigger scope of things, it's only one quarter of all of the things that need to be learned. So it's really important that we provide this information also.
Yeah, so what you look then, you look across a whole series of areas of expertise from, you know, financial and tax consultants, people who will be involved in teaching singing, people who are involved in the audition process, in the casting process, and various different aspects internationally. Because I guess, like most jobs, when you come out of college and, you know, and you've spent quite a time getting your voice to the point where it might even be considered for any of these types of productions, you haven't had time to think, I better study up me tax and contract law at the same time as I'm working out how to get that coloratura section of that Mozart aria.
Not at all. And of course, it's very important that I also very publicly say now that when any young singer is in an undergraduate program, they should only focus on those muscles, on the voice, get a technique. We can fix everything else. We can teach you everything else afterwards. And the teachers are doing incredible jobs with the curriculums that we have in place. But this is an added bonus of industry information. The other thing I would say for anybody that has a child studying singing, or any parents that would like to come and ask some questions about the different employment opportunities, not just as a performer, but also as an artistic administrator, whether that be in an opera house, for an orchestra, artist management, we provide all of that information. It's really for any job within the arts. You know, I think realistically, the more we give away of this information, and the more we can show people the different employment opportunities there are. For example, when I was studying in Dublin, I didn't realize that in Germany, if you became a principal soloist at a theater, you're a civil servant. So you have a wage every month, you have a pension, you have health insurance, maternity leave, paternity leave, all of these really interesting details that I think if we give to everybody here, they have a much better insight into what the employment opportunities are. I also have some colleagues that have decided maybe they don't like to travel as much. Yes. And would prefer to be based more solidly somewhere. And that's completely possible now in this industry to still have a big career, but do that.
And be based, so, based where you want within certain reasons. As you say, that kind of civil service aspect to the job, which many people may kind of go, oh, that sounds terribly boring. Not at all. I mean, if you think of the Abbey Players for years in this country, that's the way many actors were employed, and also the RTE rep, the radio repertory company. For actors, it was something similar. There are situations here like chamber choirs and aspects like that where professional employment can be attained and used as a kind of a, I suppose, in some ways, a foundation, a financial. It might be a small financial foundation, but it's some kind of foundation for a solo career. Let me bring in...
Tara. Yes, please. While the voice continues to grow, it's really a beautiful place, a safe place to be. I myself did 10 years at the Bavarian State Opera. In that period of time, I did 48 role debuts, but I had my own team. You know, my singing teacher was around. I had coaches. It's a really safe space to grow.
Yeah. So yeah, you have the kind of the comfort in some ways. I'm not saying it's not challenging still, but the comfort of that kind of employment security of some kind around what you're doing in the earlier stages of your career. Let me bring in Dr. Paul Quack at this point in time. Tell me, if you would, Paul, to start out, how you and Tara first met, because this is quite an interesting side to this aspect of celebrating The Voice, the event.
Yes, hello, Sean. Hi, Tara. It's so great to hear your voice. I'm so excited to be in Dublin next week. Greetings from New York City, which is where Tara and I first met. When Tara was singing here. I often see folks when they're singing at the Met Opera. And that's where this germ of an idea kind of grew. And Tara, in her usual fashion, has just made it blossom into something much greater than the sum of its parts. I'm delighted to be a part.
And I'm sure, if Tara, with your permission, it's okay for Paul to tell us the specifics of the situation in which he met you. It was a kind of illness, a sickness at the time.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, and this happens to everybody, but poor Paul has the terrible thing that he meets a lot of singers only when they're sick.
Yeah.
And it has been a brutal year this year, so I'm seeing a lot of singers in their time of illness. But, you know, that's part of the reason that I think Tara is so brilliant at bringing a doctor into this education, because the unique thing about being a singer is that your instrument is your body. You know, other instrumentalists learn to train this instrument that lives outside themselves. But when you have to contend with the daily vicissitudes of anatomy and physiology and things that affect your throat, you're sort of working with a different instrument almost every day. And people don't really get this information necessarily up front. So it's a great opportunity for people to learn about the instrument.
And in that respect, Paul, to what extent, you know, if a singer is suffering from whatever kind of illness, but particularly something that is affecting the voice, Are there ways that you can talk about, yeah, there are situations here where you can continue to sing, you can either continue to rehearse or possibly perform, but here are the health tools that you need to employ to make that possible, or equally situations where you say you need to stop singing for a period of time and you need to stop singing today?
The answers to that question are as varied as the singers out there and the situations that arise. And that's what makes my job endlessly fascinating and wonderful, but also frustrating, because it would be much easier if I could just look at a manual and say, your vocal cords look this way, you're this age, you're this gender, you're singing this role, this is what we do. But ultimately, it's a combination of what the anatomy looks like, what the role is that's coming up, what the particular illness is, and all of that plays into the decisions that we make.
And I guess from your point of view in that respect, Tara, it's vital to know when, yeah, look, get on stage. Dr. Stage will look after you for a couple of hours. But when you get off that stage, Dr. Paul will look after you at that point in time. That kind of, it's important to know when you can go on and when you can't.
It is the very difficult thing, I think, is that I certainly am a singer that finds it very hard to say no. And oftentimes to myself. Yeah. Like, I'm the one that wants to do everything, never mind the agency or the theater. But sometimes you need to, we speak a lot about building your team and the people you trust, but sometimes you need to be able to reach out to your team wherever in the world you are and wherever in the world they are, to also ask, is this foolish? Should I push myself? Should I? Because oftentimes the sad thing is, it may not actually be the voice. It could be that you have a virus in the body. It could be that you have, you know, just super duper fatigued parts of the body, so your support maybe isn't working. It can really be anything that can affect the whole performance. And I personally find it very, very difficult in those situations. And let me tell you, there's nothing more depressing than when you've flown to another country halfway across the world, you've done all the rehearsals, and then you can't sing a show, and you go back to an apartment alone and by yourself. And so these are some of the things we speak about, how to holistically also care for your mental health in those situations, how to prepare for cancelling, all of these things that, again, are difficult decisions, but you have a whole team around you to help you make them.
All right. I want to listen to a piece of music. It's near time I did that. I'm going to listen to a piece of Gabrielle Fauré, in fact. We can talk about the whys and wherefores of this particular piece after the event, Tara. But it's yourself singing along with the National Symphony Orchestra. It's a Gabrielle Fauré song called On Prière. Let's have a listen. Section there of En Prière, a Gabrielle Fauré song sung by Tara Iraq. Tara is with us this evening along with Dr. Paul Quack, talking about the Celebrating the Voice event, which is happening at the National Concert Hall, culminating on Valentine's Day, in fact, the 14th of February. It's a 5-day event particularly aimed at young singers at advanced stages of vocal development. Tell me a little bit about the song, Tara, before we get into one of the reasons that we were talking about that song and your choice of that song for us tonight.
Well, funny enough, that's actually the first French song I ever learned with Ronnie.
Ronnie Dunn, Veronica Dunn.
With yes. And I mean, Ronnie, although no longer with us, is somebody I still think of most every day when I go to sing. She taught me from the very beginning the importance of technical foundation in song. And she always said to me that my international toolkit had to be full of song, meaning that when I'm traveling and I'm alone and there's no teacher, or I don't have somebody else's ears in that moment, that I'd be able to take out these core foundational songs and make sure that everything's working. And she also taught me that at least two or three times in every season, I must do a recital with piano where it's a much more intimate situation. There's no conductor, there's no director, there's nobody to tell me what to do. I have to find the musical colors and develop my own musicianship and also stretch the instrument a little. So try things in keys maybe that I wouldn't do in the opera. Try things a little lower, a little higher, stretch the muscles a bit. And it's one of the things I speak about so much, that although there isn't a huge demand anymore for recitals, we must instill the importance of it for the vocal health aspect in these young singers. The other aspect to all of that is that one of the big privileges I have this time is that we get to do one of the galas with the National Symphony Orchestra.
Yes.
And one of the things that is often missing in our training, nobody prepares a singer how to approach an orchestra for the first time.
Yeah,
Can I come back
to that orchestral issue in a moment? But let me just stick with with that idea, because I want to make it clear that the 12 singers, they will be singing as part of an afternoon recital. Will that be with the pianists of Dervagh Collins, who many people will know in this country, and maybe Morgana Fauchois, who may not be as familiar to them, pianist and head vocal coach of opera productions at the Paris Conservatoire? Will that afternoon recital be purely piano, or will it be with orchestra as well?
No, it's purely piano, and we have a beautiful, obviously, Valentine's Day theme. Mm. So we've decided to also do the Brahms Liebeslieder. And there's so much, they're so beautiful, these Brahms love songs. Some of them are quartets, some of them are duets. And it takes a real amount of chamber musicianship, of musicianship in general from each singer to put them together. And those particular songs will be four-hand piano, which is a real treat. Oh. We don't get to do them very often. And then we also have solos within there, both in German and in French. So we're going to work a lot on the linguistic skills. We're going to work on the style. But all of this is also preparation should they ever do symphonic work, because we focus so much on the opera in the training, but some of this symphonic work and song work, it slips through the cracks.
Yes.
And it's really important vocal health-wise that we insist that singers continue to do recitals.
And that's, I just wanted you to give us that recital aspect, and the fact that it's piano four hands, so there's two pianos with the two of them sitting at one piano is a moot point. We don't need to get into that. However, it will be two players making a lot more sound than one, a lot more sound than one player. So then that jump, like repetiteurs, the people who a young singer is brought into the room to go through the music, he or she playing on the piano, bringing them through all of those aspects, that is very much part of the training. But as you say, the chance to sing and play with an orchestra practically just doesn't exist for a young singer, or very seldom for a young singer in training. So are you going to talk a little bit about that over the 5 days?
We absolutely are. And I mean, there really is a whole different approach to that, because regardless of what you prepare with a pianist, when you go and you meet a conductor for the first time, they have ideas of their own about the particular aria or the piece, and they will go and rehearse with the orchestra before you ever come along. So a lot of that's already set up. And of course, when you come in and there's 60 people on the stage there, you're not there in competition. You're never going to be louder than them, but you have to figure out how to become part of their chamber music on a bigger scale. And it's this beautiful kind of, the rehearsals can be very intimate and quite beautiful, but it's to help the singers never to be afraid of that. And from a vocal health aspect, it's to help the younger singers not panic and push. Because when you come in and you see maybe, you know, three trombones and five trumpets and French horns, you panic. Panic and you push. You try to make yourself louder. And the only person that hears it louder is sadly yourself.
Yeah.
So it's to make sure that we're coming at that from the most healthy position that we possibly can. I mean, we are blessed that Paul did all of his training as a pianist. He's so musical. Even when he speaks to you, he speaks in this beautiful, calm lilt. It's so calming. But because Paul understands all of the musicianship and all of the foundational work of that, I find it's just so comforting.
Yeah,
then no matter what he says, I take it. I would never question it.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, Paul, about that precise point. I mean, obviously, you have your medical background and your medical training, but you are a pianist, and indeed you studied at Juilliard, so you're obviously were a musician and are a musician of some note. What do you think that, no pun intended, obviously, what do you think that brings to your practice, as Tara has put it there, when you're working with the vocal health aspect of things, that I suppose that knowledge of the music as much as anything else, thinking that foray piece and the fact that it doesn't seem to my ear to go very high or very low, but by Lord, does it demand big, long phrases?
Yes. I think for me, it's language and vocabulary. And I think what this festival is a lot about is giving everyone a common language and vocabulary to understand how to raise singers in the healthiest way possible. And I think my advantage, having studied the repertoire and the music before, is that I can speak the foreign language to most doctors of repertoire, tessitura, voice, Fach. Mm-hmm. And my hope in the talks that I will give is that I hope to give some of my language and vocabulary to the vocalists and the teachers so that we are all speaking the same language. Because I think what's hard when you come into a doctor's office, it's very hard to know what it means when a vocal cord is inflamed or when there's a lesion or when something looks red or irritated. And I think that can be very intimidating, and it's hard for singers to make some progress when they lack that vocabulary. So for me, this is about finding a common language.
Yeah, and I guess the other aspect of it is, which we should point out, it's not just professional singers who might gain from that. Perish the thought, there might be radio presenters, there might be actors, there might be singing teachers, there might be people involved in amateur choirs. I mean, I remember at one stage myself teaching and doing a lot of drama at night, and I just had to learn how to use my voice because it was it was my professional tool during the day, and it was my fun tool in the evening time, and then went on to become much, obviously, something totally different. But I had to learn how to use it, and it was important to do so. So finally, Tara, there are so many things. I mean, Liz Nolan will be presenting all of those panel discussions, and an extraordinary number of international and national people involved. Gabby Smith from the financial side, Dr. Paul, as we mentioned, Alexander Neef, Director of the General of the Paris Opera, Dervla Collins and Morgan Fouchois, we've mentioned already. Andreas Massow, Artist Manager, Casting Director at the Bayerische Staatsoper, former Casting Director. All of those people will be present in various conversations. But the big gala event with orchestra will be on Valentine's evening. And you will be singing at that. And I'm going to finish with a little bit of that. What will you be singing on the night? I'm not too surprised by your choice here, I have to admit.
Well, I mean, I couldn't come home after such a long period of time and not offer some Rossini. And come on, every girl wants to be a princess. So I will do the big wedding aria from La Cenerentola, from Rossini's Cinderella.
Well, I decided to go a little bit in. I'm sure you'll forgive me. I've gone about halfway through to the little bit where you get to show really what coloratura Rossini singing is all about. We listen to that as we let you go. Thank you so much, Tara, for being with us this evening. Best of luck. I'll give people full details about the event in a moment after we listen to you. And Dr. Paul Quack, thanks for being with us as well. Thanks both.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
That is Dr. Paul. Oh, there we go. There's Rossini coming in.
Albeit staccando il fuoco, starò sola a gorgheggiar l'anno. Affullammo un sogno, un gioco, il mio lungo malvito.
Well, they might cheer. That is the National Symphony Orchestra and Tara Rocks with the Non più messa aria, the wedding aria from Rossini's La Cenerentola. You would want to have done your years of training, and you would want your voice to be in the full of its health to carry off that particular performance. Thanks so much to Tara Rock and Dr. Paul Quack for speaking with me tonight. Paul's event, Celebrating the Voice, takes place on the opening night, Monday the 10th of February at 7:30 p.m. That's in the Kevin Barry Recital Room. And Tara, along with hosting the celebration, will perform that particular, the full of that aria, at the Opera Gala on the final night, February the 14th, Valentine's night, at 7:30 p.m. on the main stage. And you can find out full details of the entire 5-day event and all of the discussions on nch.ie. Now, we've just been talking about Valentine's night in the National Concert Hall. This Valentine's Day is the centenary of the birth of Valmuel Kearns, author, journalist and founder member of Is Donna, a unique figure in Irish letters and one of the few women to have played an active role in Irish literary life in the 1950s. To mark the occasion of this centenary, her debut novel is being reissued. A Time Out Worn is an unusual take on the coming-of-age story, in this case of a bright, bookish Maeve Cusack, set in the mid-1940s, first published in 1951. It captures a time and a place on the cusp of seismic change. Delighted that Val's daughter, the writer and journalist Maeve Kennedy, is with me in studio this evening. I'm looking at the new edition. And the wonderful picture of...
Isn't it gorgeous?
As I thought, it was kind of from a still from The Quiet Man or a still from Ryan's Daughter or something like that.
Who can this beautiful young woman on the cover be? So it's not stated because the book is a novel, but that is my mother in 1955. She's standing on a dolman in Achill. I'm a year old and I've been dumped with Liam Miller of the Dolman Press, who was another great family friend. And there's this careless creature with her jeans legs rolled up. She told me that when she started wearing jeans after she was married, she used to steal my father's jeans because you could not buy jeans for a woman in Dublin in those days. And the little boys who lived on the road used to run after her throwing stones, shouting Calamity Jane.
Of course, it has that. That's why I was saying it looks kind of like a film still. Yeah. It has that look off it, the American films of the day.
And it's a real art director's touch. I remembered the photograph vividly. What I had forgotten is the real art directory thing is there's a pile of books at her feet. And knowing Val, it'll be Singh and Yeats being piled up at her feet.
I would say they were not just books casually thrown down.
No. And there is a lot of Singh and Yeats in this book, I have to say.
Well, in fact, it starts in a time I'm skipping over both the foreword and the introduction from Carla Gebhardt and the introduction from yourself.
I'm shocked.
Just for a moment, I shall return to them, because, in fact, part one of the novel opens with the last summer, the W.B. Yeats poems, and there are other references to Yeats and, as you say, Singh throughout the piece itself. But tell me a little bit, because I want to talk about the relationship between the Maeve Cusack that we get in this book and your mother.
Yes. Well, no. Val was bookish to the extreme, high culture to the extreme. She genuinely had no taste for popular culture, except, funnily enough, Downton Abbey got her in the end. She became a Downton Abbey addict, and I used to laugh at her terribly over it. She had massive reading lists from the age of 10. We have all her diaries, which will all go to the National Library. And she made lists of things she needed to read, music she needed to listen to. She made notes on every concert she ever went to. She was sometimes going to 3 concerts a week at the age of, 12, 13. She had no taste for film, which was odd because her brother, Jim Mulkerns, went on to be a brilliant Irish filmmaker. And there are various contemptuous references in the novel to film, to cinemas, to gaudy cinemas.
And that's her digging at her brother a bit. Well, at that stage, was he established?
He'd certainly have been sneaking into the back row of the Saturday matinees to watch films at that stage. And he was already very interested in photography. She was very high-minded. She was very serious, but she was very funny as well. She had a very sharp sense of humour, and she had a very sharp way with words. She didn't let fools off lightly.
And that strikes me, that Maeve Cusack, in the fictional character in the novel, A Time Out Worn, has lots of the above qualities.
She has. I mean, I went through Val's diaries to write the foreword. Sorry, I know you're going to come back to it.
Yeah.
And I was struck by how many resemblances there are between Maeve and the character. Maeve in the novel escapes a job in the civil service. She escapes learning to type and sitting there. I think one of the friends says, playing a typewriter for some fool for the rest of my life.
And that would have been considered an absolutely brilliant job to have attained at that point in time.
The definitive, permanent pensionable job in the civil service. So Val did get the permanent pensionable job in the civil service. And as soon as, because she didn't like the character in the book, she did not get a scholarship. She got a very good leaving cert. She didn't get a scholarship. They couldn't have afforded to send her to university. So she was stuck exactly like the character in the book. The character in the book goes off to work in a small Irish town. Val did get the job in the civil service. And from the moment she had it, she was desperate to shake it off and go and be a writer. That was
the ambition.
There are great things in the diaries. At one stage, there's a rant, God deliver me from mediocrity in art, in life, in virtue, in living, in vice, in dying. I loathe the prospect of going to Skerry's, which was a blameless commercial college that taught you shorthand and typing and trained people up for the civil service exams. I loathe the prospect of it, and the bovine, smug civil service crowd. The prospect appalls me. These were the people she was working with. Yeah. These were the unfortunates in her office.
Yeah, and it is the type of language that she gives to Maeve.
It's exactly the type of language she gives to Maeve.
The reason I asked you that very point about the similarities between your mother and Maeve, it is in Carlo Gebler's foreword that he says towards the end of that foreword, in fact, about this idea that your mother reassigned the novel as a memoir.
It is a very interesting idea. There are things in the book that certainly I relate to in family history. Mm. There's a very good scene early on where there's a terrible argument between Maeve's father, who is a diehard Irish rebel, now at home in his armchair when he can't get out a whiskey bottle, and his great friend who has been injured in the First World War. Now, Val's father was J.J. Mulkerns, the Raja of Phrong Gok, who kept the nickname forever after, out of the theatre company he founded in the prison camp when he was interned after 1916. But his brother-in-law...
Phrong Gok being the famous internment camp in Wales, where Brendan Behan went later on.
He was in the same hut as Michael Collins, who he adored for the rest of his life, and he detested De Valera for the rest of his life. And my grandfather's brother-in-law was Edward Sands, who had fought in a cavalry regiment in the First World War and had been gassed like the character in this novel, George. Both of them were left with weak chests for the rest of their lives. So I think the passionate arguments about England's difficulty being Ireland's opportunity and vice versa, I think they very much come from Val's own background.
Yeah, because it is interesting within the novel itself. Yes, there's this strong story of Maeve Cusack and her life and Dermot, who's the kind of the love interest, and it's interesting. The love interest is the man in this particular case. Dermot, who's the love interest. There is that aspect to the book which is a strong story, a strong Bildungsroman type of story. But there is also, it is a comment on Irish society of that period as well.
Very much so. Such an interesting period, isn't it, Sean, when the tectonic shape plates are beginning to shift. So there is gentle mockery of the parish priest in the small town. There is explicit contempt for the sort of piodiousness of Irish society. There is the little simple old-fashioned tea rooms in Howth, which serves poor teas at a low price, is contrasted with what's happening in Dublin, which is the beginning of cafolas and places like that, ice cream parlours and coffee bars with bright lights. And there's a real contempt for that sort of what she would see as a very superficial, very commercial Irish society. And a very sentimental feeling, I have to say, that the real Irish society lays in the west of Ireland, in real value.
Well, in some ways, Maeve Cusack, the fictional character's story of heading back down the country and becoming a librarian, obviously in the world of books and in that wonderful mind in expanding realm, but in rural Ireland, essentially. It's interesting that that's where she chooses to send her.
And in that little town, there is the bank. There's the hotel with the stag's heads in the hall. There are several pubs. There's the church hall. But there's a cinema. There's a new cinema there. She is not blind to the changes that are
happening. She's
given
in to the brother. She's allowing him to have a career perhaps in cinema as well.
Yes, absolutely.
One brief thing I did want to pick up on is this aspect that Carlo Gebler speaks about again in that foreword, about remembering they lived quite close to you in Rathgar at one point in time.
Yeah, 10 doors up the road. Yeah,
and his memory is you went into that house and it was kind of like a literary playground.
Well, that was true enough. He remembers lots of typewriters. My father, who was also a writer, Maurice Kennedy, a lovely writer, from the time they met, when Val rejected a short story of his when she was deputy editor of The Bell, and fell down the stairs to
good
his feet.
Good to get the power dynamics sorted early on.
Fell down the stairs to his feet and reader, she married him. my father typed every word that Val wrote for the rest of her career, for the rest of his life. It was a very literary household. We used to be locked out, the three of us used to be locked out into the back garden when Val was writing. Yeah. She worked like a fiend for the rest of her life. But she had a sense of fun, and I think that's maybe one of the things that's slightly missing in this very early book. Maeve is deadly serious.
Oh, she's a very serious young woman,
There are a few other jokers in it. The one thing I would appeal to people is it says the end, and then you have to turn the page and you come to the epilogue. I had actually forgotten the epilogue, which is truly startling. Val's male characters, I have always thought, are better than her women characters. And the character of Maeve's brother, Brendan, when he's first introduced, I actually thought, he's a very good character to be throwing away so quickly. And he isn't. He comes back in the end. There is an astonishing reversal in the end, which caused some controversy when the book came out. Some people hated it.
But it was very well received. And it's as fresh today as it was back in 1951, I would have thought. Maeve, lovely to have spoken with you. We could talk about so much more, but Let people go read the book and don't stop when it says the end. No. Turn the page.
Turn the pages to the epilogue. It's in bookshops already. The official publication date was Valentine's Day, the centenary of Val's birth.
Yeah.
But there was literally a demand for it. So it's in bookshops already.
451 editions.
451 editions are fabulous publishers. It is already in Hodges Figgis, Kenny's, The Winding Stair, Books Upstairs, the beautiful book and coffee shop in Kilkenny, which I adore. Dubray is taking a huge order. And you can order it. It's on book all websites. Yeah. It's on Barnes & Noble.
Do it via a local bookshop if you
go
can.
Go for an independent
and
bookshop.
And even their websites. They all have websites.
Yeah, absolutely.
Lovely so much, Maeve. Thanks for coming into us this evening. Maeve
Kennedy. It's been a real pleasure.
That's Maeve Kennedy speaking to us about her mother's debut novel, her mother being Val Mulcairns, and that debut novel being A Time Out Worn, and a special anniversary edition with a foreword by Carlo Gebler, an introduction by Maeve herself, and it is published by 451 Editions. Jess Gillam is an internationally renowned saxophonist from Cumbria, known for her dynamic performances and eclectic musical style. The first saxophonist to reach the BBC Young Musician Finals and the youngest soloist at the last night of the proms. She's since topped the UK classical charts, won a Classical Brit Award, and has been a vocal advocate for music education, arguing that it should be treated as a core subject in schools. She joins the Irish Chamber Orchestra this week for a special concert, series of concerts titled Bach to Bowie. I'm delighted that Jess is joining us from our Limerick studios this evening. You know, that word eclectic, sometimes when I see it, it kind of brings me out in a type of a rash. Jess, I don't know about you, but when I think of the saxophone and that instrument, it's not surprising that you play such a wide variety of music. It's such a young instrument in orchestral terms, and yet when you think of it and music throughout the 20th century, popular music throughout the 20th century through to this contemporary moment, it really is one of those instruments that crosses all boundaries.
It really is. Hello, nice to be talking to you.
You too.
Yeah, the saxophone, it's a brilliant instrument. It was patented in 1846 by Mr. Sax, Adolf Sax, and its dynamism and versatility is, I think, unparalleled. It's got such a vocal sound that's able to emulate all different types of instruments in the orchestra or in a band, which means that it can play just about any style.
And it goes across, because people generally think of it, I think, as a jazz instrument, but it can go across lots of different styles. And its use within the orchestra, like 1845, we're talking about the point at which the orchestra had reached its kind of romantic heights, or was certainly on its way to reaching its romantic heights into the early part of the 20th century. How does the saxophone fare in that particular aspect of music?
So it was originally designed as a military instrument. There was a competition in France for instrument makers to design an instrument whose sound would travel across long plains. And Mr. Sax won. It was the loudest outdoor instrument there was. And that meant that composers at the time, some were very, I guess you could say, resistant to it,
yeah,
a little bit snobby about it, saying that, you know, it was an outsider instrument, it would never fit in. And then some composers, people like Berlioz, loved the sound of it and loved its soulfulness. But really, it was ever so slightly rejected by classical music, so it was adopted, I think, by jazz, and it grew up and has its roots and history in dance music of the 1910s and 20s. And then it's kind of come full circle and now is used in every style because of how versatile its sound is. Yeah.
I think possibly Shostakovich was one of the early orchestral exponents of the instrument. But let's listen to you playing. Even the title of this piece suggests to me a mixture of styles. Pakena Chardash, two types of dances, two different parts of the world, am I right?
Yeah, it's by a Spanish saxophonist, but inspired by a Hungarian folk dance. So you've got the eclecticism going already.
Well, this is you playing that particular piece, Jess Gillam. Thank you. Kenna Chardash, part of that piece from a Spanish composer as Jess Gillam, the saxophonist that you heard playing in that recording and who's speaking with me from her Limerick, from our Limerick studios this evening ahead of her performance with the Irish Chamber Orchestra, upcoming performances. I'll give you details of those shortly. It really has that mixture of styles that you suggested there. And from that kind of plaintive Spanish feel to it, and then the Chardash, that Hungarian dance, which really has, you know, you can almost feel the feet kicking up. Was it all, which particular voice of the saxophone do you play? Because there are tenor saxophones, alto saxophones, baritone saxophones, soprano saxophones, Jess.
Yeah, the saxophone family is huge. The smallest saxophone is just bigger than a cutlery fork. That's the soprillo. And the biggest is the tubax or the contrabass. And that's nearly 7 feet tall. So it's a huge family. But I play mainly soprano. You heard the soprano just there. And that's a straight one, slightly high. And I also play a bit of alto and tenor as well. But really mainly soprano. I love its vocal and soulful quality.
Yeah, and it's on you. Yes, you can get the curved soprano saxophone, but for the most part, it is more like an oboe or clarinet in that it's held straight out from the mouth. It's probably a little bit bigger than a clarinet, I would guess.
Yeah, and obviously heavier because it's metal. Mine's actually bronze, and you get that kind of a bigger range of sound. You've got that warmth, and you've also got the ability to cut right over and huge volume and dynamic potential with it as well.
And I don't know if you've ever heard the saxophonist Jan Garbarek, who plays kind of ancient or early music in churches, and you really hear this very modern instrument in a very ancient type of setting, and you realise it may not have been invented until the 1840s, but boy, can it do music from the 16th and 1500s.
Yeah, absolutely. And he has, again, that's a perfect example of someone whose sound is just like the voice. Because that famous record with the Hilliard Ensemble, he's there playing with a choir and he just becomes another member of it because he's able to kind of mould the sound and shape it. And he plays on a little curved soprano, so that looks like a baby saxophone, but the one I play on is the straight out one.
I know you're a huge advocate in terms of music education, and this is the idea. I know funding has been cut in Britain in recent times, but this is the idea that every child should have access to a musical instrument in primary school. And, you know, they're not all going to become professional musicians, but there's more to it than that, I think you would argue.
Absolutely. You know, to learn sport is to learn how to be a member of a team and to learn discipline and to learn how to communicate and cooperate. And it's the same with music, but also involving another, maybe slightly more emotional side as well. Mm. You know, learning how to connect with something that's outside of your body, but all of the expression is coming from within, learning to make mistakes and things that are outside of the kind of black and white that an education can sometimes be. You know, it's either right or wrong. But with music, there's not really a wrong. If you've got good intentions and you're, you know, practicing and learning an instrument, then there's so much good and joy and happiness, which we need in the world, which can come from it.
Yeah, and any type of ensemble playing is always going to, everybody benefits from that. It's like a team sport as opposed to a solo sport. You know, the learning to be part of a team is hugely important. As I've mentioned, you go from Bach, his flute concerto, CPE Bach, that is, you'll be playing a saxophone version of that. Mendelssohn's Sinfonia, that's just the orchestra themselves. David Heath's The Celtic, that's a wonderful piece, which has all kinds of Celtic, almost traditional sounds within it. Jess.
Yeah, it is. It's in three parts. It opens with this ceilidh, and you hear these beautiful hazy string lines, and then the saxophone comes in as the riot and the party, and then there's loads of communication and call and response throughout the piece with the strings, with the orchestra. We were just rehearsing it today, and it's an absolute riot. It's good fun.
And I see Riot, you have Rant at the end of the programme from John Hard, which probably, I'm guessing the name tells us a lot about it. Boulanger's Cantique, again, Cantique tells us probably about the wonderful melodic quality that can be got from the instrument in that. But in the midst of all of that is an arrangement of David Bowie's Life on Mars.
Indeed. I think one thing I love about kind of these juxtapositions in programming or putting together music by Bach to Bowie to you know, contemporary music, Boulanger and their pieces, you start to see these connections. Mm. There's actually, we've got in Western music, we have the 12 notes, and you hear them in all kinds of arrangements played by all kinds of different instruments. And when you start to put them together and listen, you know, with kind of open mind and open ear, you realize actually there's nothing too different about the way Nadia Boulanger was expressing love in her song Cantique to Life on Mars, David Bowie's Alien song. And there's lots of threads of similarities and connections right across eras and genres and time.
We don't have that particular arrangement of Life on Mars, but we do have a David Bowie piece. Where are we now? Is this from his 2013 album, The Next Day, but this is you playing. Is this on one of your current albums, or is it a single, or where can we hear more of this type of thing, Jess?
This is on my first album, released in 2019, called Rise.
Called Rise, for obvious reasons, because it was your first album and you certainly were rising and continue to do so. Lovely to have spoken with you. We'll finish by listening to a little bit of Where Are We Now, Jess, and I'll give people full details of where you are with the Irish Chamber Orchestra after that. Thanks so much for coming into our Limerick studios this evening.
Thank you, Sean. Take care.
Take care of you as well. That's Jess Gillam. And here she is with a little bit of David Bowie's Where Are We Now? Melody is a good melody. Where Are We Now from David Bowie, but in a version there for saxophone played by Jess Gillam. And what a set of concerts Jess promises to give over the coming nights. She will be at the Town Hall Theatre in Galway tomorrow evening, at the Lark Concert Hall in Balbriggan in Dublin, where we were ourselves before with the Stephen Ray interview back in January. She'll be there on Friday, February the 17th. Tomorrow evening in Balbriggan, and then on Friday, February the 7th at the University Concert Hall in Limerick. On Saturday, 8th of February. I've mixed up those dates in the way I read them, so it would be well worth your while checking out the website, irishchamberorchestra.com. Town Hall Theatre tomorrow, Lark Concert Hall Friday, University Concert Hall Limerick Saturday. Hope that clarifies things. The irishchamberorchestra.com. And that is our lot for this, is it Wednesday? It is indeed Wednesday already. Paula Shields and Liam Murphy researched. Alex Lopatin was the broadcast coordinator. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Keshi. Back with you tomorrow night at 7 here on RT Radio 1. And yes, indeed, John Creedon will be with you after the news.